the funky Kelly. 1, 2, 3, 4. I was working in the bank, two paychecks every Friday and a Mars miner out in the back. But I was mad for jigs and reels, drinking dirty big pints of stout. When the Bank of Ireland gave me the boot, they said, John, at the door, hit your arse on the way out.
April 13th, 1993, I was in the studio audience of Late Night with David Letterman. It was one of the final programs that Letterman did at NBC before he went over to CBS. And making their television network debut was a band by the name of Black 47. And I was in the audience and I got to see them perform. They performed Maria's Wedding. I was already a fan of the band, but it was the first time I'd ever seen them live. And it was amazing. And I will never forget that moment. So imagine how thrilled I am to have Larry Kerwin on the program this morning. He is an author, a musician. Yes, he was the leader of the New York-based Irish political rock band Black 47 for 25 years. He is the author of 5 previous books, including Liverpool Fantasy, A History of Irish Music, and Green Suede Shoes. His brand new book, which is absolutely stunning, is called Rockaway. I don't have the second word. What is it?
Blue.
Thank you very much. I just said Rockaway B, and I was like, I don't know what that is. I didn't check myself, Larry. Rockaway Blue. The book is stunning. It is so gorgeous, and we'll talk about it in just a minute. Larry, I'm thrilled that you're on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Joe. It's always a pleasure to having to do with the capital region. I have so many great friends up there and so many links with it and so many nights that I can't remember.
especially McGeary's. Oh, McGeary's. Yeah. Well, I think I saw you at McGeary's once. That's right. Now, let me ask you this question. It's a twofer. One is that I'm assuming that on most St. Patrick's days, during the heyday of the band, you wouldn't have been up this early, and certainly not on the 18th of March, you wouldn't have been up this early.
Well, actually, we would stay up the whole night because what we would usually do is we'd be playing somewhere like Boston on the night before, and we'd drive home from that gig, and then we'd usually have a television show like the one you saw, and the road manager wouldn't allow us to go home because he would be such a hassle getting us all back together again.
Yeah.
So he would make arrangements and bring us right to the studio, and we'd go to the green room and, you know, pass out there or whatever, and then do the, you know, you record those shows in the evening, and then we go right from that to one of the big clubs in New York and play that night. And usually the next day we were heading somewhere like Philly, because Philly would have often had their St. Patrick's Day celebration the next day. So for the whole month before it, or even 6 weeks before it, there wouldn't be very much sleep. I think that's why I still don't sleep that well after all that.
It was 25 years before you said, okay, we're going to stop now. Is there any aspect of that you miss?
Oh, I miss the guys. You know, we were 25 years together, most of us.
Yeah.
And it was like a family. Because we did 2,500 gigs in 25 years, so there was a kind of a constant movement. I miss the movement sometimes, even just being on the highway. I just got so used to that. But there were other things I wanted to do, too. And what we did was, it actually happened in Buffalo. We were playing the South Buffalo Irish Festival, and it was an amazing gig. And I remember thinking when I'm on stage, you know, this is about 23 and a half years into, I remember thinking, man, it doesn't get much better than this. And then it just struck me at that point, because I'm a boxing fan, maybe we should go out now. You know? And I thought about it for about a month or so. It wouldn't leave me. And then finally, I put it to the guys in the band, said, you know, maybe we should work forward to our 25th anniversary and record a new album in that time and just go back and play everywhere that we had played, you know, offer to play the smallest places and, of course, the bigger places. And anywhere we'd played, we would go back and play for a night. And it was there was a lot of those. So that took about 15 months. And then it came to the final night. And that was it. It was just very strange.
At B.B. King's in Manhattan was the final gig, right?
Yeah. And, you know, a funny thing about that, I was the last one to leave. I'd actually forgotten something. I had to go back in, and I came out, and by then the crowd had gone and everything. And up above was Black 47 last performance or something like that. And I remember the very first time I got into a professional band was back in Wexford in Ireland. And the leader of the band was this real character. He was like from the 40s and 50s, this guy, you know, who's a saxophone or a trumpet player. And he said to me, Kerwin, you know, I know you're very young and everything, you're 16 or something. And he said, there's only two pieces of advice I'll give you in this racket. He said, get paid and get out alive. Not necessarily in that order. And I remember standing outside B.B. King's after 2,500 gigs and thinking, we got paid. We got out alive, job well done, and that was it. And then I went off and partied.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty nice feeling, isn't it? When you were a young guy in Wexford, and I've heard you talk about the idea of the band. I remember even Letterman asking you that night, you know, are you an Irish band? And you didn't really have the chance to make the point, but you have made the point that it's an Irish-American band. It is about that Irish-American experience, especially in New York. And but as a guy from Wexford, do you consider yourself still to be an Irishman, or is it more, no, I'm an Irish-American?
You know, I was up in the Bronx one night, and I was we were playing a gig. This is in the early days of Black 47.
Yeah.
And there was an old guy sitting at the bar, and he said, "You're an immigrant. I'm an immigrant. That means one thing." He said, "You're neither here nor there." And it struck me at the time. You're neither here nor there. You don't fit back home anymore, but you don't totally fit here, because, you know, you have the accent and your right. Children are Americans and you're Irish, kind of, you know. This I do consider myself to be American at this point, Irish American. I'm more comfortable here in many ways. When I go back, it takes me about 3 or 4 days to really fit back in as an Irish person. Whereas I don't have that feeling when I hit New York. It's like, hallelujah, I'm home, baby.
Well, and that's it. You feel at home. But it was, and so much of what you wrote about, especially in those early years, you were writing about making that change of coming from Ireland to this country and what that was like. But you got the idea even through the music that felt right. New York felt right to you.
Yeah, right from the start. And, you know, Chris Byrne was a really important part of Black 47. He was my co-founder.
Yep.
He was a New York City detective and also an Ellen Pipe player and a Brooklyn rapper. So, I was joining
a rapper with a badge. That's right.
Exactly. What was it Letterman called? I thought it was really funny. That guy was just so sharp. He said, "What is that you're playing? A stick in a carpet?" Thinking, wow, did you think of that just now? Is what I want to ask him. Or are you that smart?
Pretty great. Yeah.
Yeah. So right from the start, the way I saw it, and I had been in bands. I had a major record deal before that with a band called Major Thinkers, and then we got dropped. And I got out of the whole business. I got really sick of the business side of things. And I went off to become a playwright and worked at that for about 4 years without, you know, I was playing music, but not, I was playing improv music, downtown stuff and everything. And, but I'd gotten out of the business. And when I met Chris, I got up on stage with his band Beyond the Pale at a place called Paddy Riley's. And I hadn't played on stage in an Irish place or in a kind of that kind of environment in about 4 years. And I felt really liberated being back on stage because I'd been so much into playwriting. I was just becoming kind of a bit of a hermit. And I got up on stage and I had the time of my life. And I was drinking whiskey and it was like the old days kind of. And then I see Chris at the end of the night. I'm sitting beside him at the bar and I said, well, you know, what's the problem, man? And he said, well, you know, the band is breaking up tonight and I have all these gigs up in the Bronx lined up and, you know, I got a couple of kids and everything and I got no one to play with. I said, I'll do it. And he said, really? I said, yeah, why not? And he said, what do we call ourselves? I said, there's only one name, Black 47. Has to be Black 47. And Chris was very political anyway, so he got it instantly. And our idea right from the start, if we had an idea, because we were thrown right into the Bronx, we decided we're going to play just original music. But we will do the 4 sets a night, which I had to do in the Bronx. And, of course, we only had about a week to rehearse, so I knocked off about 10 original songs. I had about 6 old ones and 4 new ones, and Chris came in. We rehearsed them all in one night. So we weren't that together, you could say. And we went up to the Bronx, and they hated us. Man, it was like people were walking out, giving us the finger and everything. But there was a boom. There had been a boom in the Bronx, and there were all these bars that needed music. Because whatever it is about the Bronx, you have to have live music in a bar. And we were the only ones. So right from the start, what we were doing is we were putting our idea of Irish music through the prism of New York and all its influences. So we were including, you know, rap, reggae, and then when Fred and Jeff, the two horn players, joined, we were incorporating a lot of free jazz and Dixieland and Spanish music, whatever it was, because I was bringing all these songs in, and I was ambitious musically too, though, not just lyrically, that this band can play anything and we can transform whatever I'm bringing in by adding all these different influences to it. And, you know, Fred, the trombone player, came from a jazz and big band background. Jeff was from Dexy's Midnight Runners, which is kind of blue-eyed soul. And Hammy, the drummer, was into African music. So we would just, we never rehearsed, because to rehearse means you miss a gig. And we were into supporting our families and everything. Yeah. So what we would do is we'd have a sound check before it, and I would have 6 sheets printed up. And there's the chords, man. And I would teach the horn players, you know, a simple instrumental riff, whatever it was going to be. And I said, now we do it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Here it is. And we would do it once or twice during the sound check, and it would be goddamn awful. You know, I can imagine. But we would kind of make the mistakes during the sound check, and then we would do it live on stage that night. And people would be standing there thinking, what is this? Yeah. And our one goal was, you get from A to Z. Don't worry about making mistakes. There's a start and there's a finish, and whatever happens in between, you're on your own, babe.
I ask this as a completely serious question before we go to a break, but would you, if you were drinking whiskey while singing, was that good for your voice?
I didn't drink before I went on. I would go on with a pint of ale, usually, or and I'd have half a trunk by the time we got on stage. So I was kind of, because the audiences were really revved up too. You know, yeah. they'd been drinking all day, kind of. And when we would come to town, it was party time and political time. So you couldn't almost face this audience without a drink. And then about two-thirds of the way through the gig, our road manager, Nico, is this big black guy, would come on stage with a shot for me. Or not a shot, but a glass, because he didn't want to be bothered to get me a second one. And then I would start drinking some whiskey. And that gave you that boost right through. You know, whiskey can actually loosen things up, you know.
We were
a loose band.
Yeah, you were a loose band indeed. As was the audience, which made it so much fun. Whiskey of choice?
I usually went with one of the two, whatever they had, either Jemsons or Bushmills, meat and potatoes whiskey.
That's right. Yeah, good stuff.
People were drinking it, so it was going to be kind of fresh. You know? I'm going to be in the bottle for, 6 months up on
the right.
shelf.
Aged
you're
in the bottle.
All the dust, too.
Right. Matured for 20 years on the shelf of McGarry's. Let's take a break. We'll take a quick break.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk about the political aspect and goodness, I want to talk about the novel, too, which is just beautiful. It is called Rockaway Blue. We will come back with Larry Kerwin after this short break.
One, two, three, four. Line, dance, drink, and love and die. To hell with the begrudgers. I see you laugh across the bar. Your eyes are like collapsing stars. All I want to ask is, would you come dance with me, darling? Don't keep it away. Then while our boys just one more the same, the streets are exploding. I'll see you okay.
Man, it doesn't get any better than that. Larry Kerwin is with us, the leader of the New York-based Irish political rock band Black 47 and author of the new novel Rockaway Blue. So, man, that is so great to hear that. So I want to talk about the idea of you being a political band. And that was something, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that wasn't a label you were given. That was really a label you gave yourself.
Well, we didn't even... didn't even think of it that much. It was just that Chris and I were both really political, and we formed in October, November 89, and things were going really badly in the north of Ireland at that point. And we were just totally in favor of civil rights in the north of Ireland and in a united Ireland itself. So, that's what we were about. And I guess from another point of view, we were progressive. Irish America was fairly hidebound at that point, and both socially and politically. And our idea was to explode the whole thing and put Irish issues right off the back burner, right up in the front, at that point. And it was a time of Clinton and everything, and whatever people think of Bill Clinton now, he did tremendous work to get the peace process going in Ireland, but also just to say that Gerry Adams can come to the U.S. It's not up to the British Home Office to talk about that. That's something that should be done. So all these different things, that's what we were after. We were writing songs that were both sympathetic and empathetic with that point of view. So we were political without even going out and shouting it. I mean, people knew what they were coming to see. If they were coming to see Black 47, they were going to get politics. They were going to get the two P's, I always thought, politics and party.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't, we felt that, you know, if someone comes to see a rock and roll band play, be it Irish or whatever, they should get that whole experience of rock and roll, you know, because the way we saw it was there comes a point on stage where everything clicks. And at that point, it's a rock and roll experience. And so we're combining that with singing songs like James Connolly and Time to Go and whatever, Bobby Sands. So there was an intensity to the band that you didn't see that anywhere else much. I mean, we were great friends, say, with The Clash, with Joe Strummer particularly. He was a big booster of Black 47. And we learned a lot from watching The Clash, but we also had a sense of humor about the whole thing. I mean, you can't be in a rock and roll band traveling around unless you got humor, because it's Murphy's Law out there. Whatever will go wrong, will go wrong. And everything went wrong with Black 47 at one point or another, from shootings to van crashes to getting banned from Irish festivals during the Iraq War, because we came out against it. It was a stupid war, and you could tell what the end result was going to be. The New York Times couldn't tell. You know, they were supporting it at the start, but on the night of the invasion, we there was kind of a semi-riot at the gig we were playing, because our left-wing fans and our right-wing fans disagreed over us coming out so strongly against the war. At that point, the war was patriotic, and I was thinking, this war is stupid. It's gonna end in a bad way, and our fans are gonna get killed over there doing the fighting. So, you know, we had a lot of irons in the fire politically at that point, and yeah, we stuck to our guns the whole time.
You certainly did. I mean, you had, of course, an Iraq album. You had you made the point, which I think was a very good one, that the war was one which the working class was fighting, and
yep.
You were very much putting that front and center as you were discussing it. You know, I there's so many places to go here, but one of the things that I think is so beautiful about your songwriting is that you could go from those moments of complete party, and then it's not until you're maybe in the car listening to the song that you realize what you're saying and how meaningful it is and how much there is there to unpack and discuss. And I thought about that as I was reading Rockaway Blue, because it is such a beautiful story, and it is in the days after, well, 3 years, right, after 9/11, and
yeah.
About an Irish-American family primarily, and who are trying to figure out what happened on that day to a loved one. And what led you to that? And not so much what led you to that, but what led you to that at this time, that it was still something very much on your mind?
Well, as you say, there's so many different ways to look at this. When 9/11 happened, for instance, a lot of young Irish Americans joined up the forces, joined up the service, because they wanted to show solidarity with their country. And, you know, a lot, our audience tended to be working class and lower middle class. I mean, it was all classes, but that was the big, we were speaking for those classes. And so a lot of these kids went into the army, and I knew a lot of them. And before they know it, they're sent to Iraq. You know, it was just, you know, they join for one thing, they're sent to invade another country, whereas they joined up to actually defend their own country. So it's all these lies and deceit and everything. So that was one of the things we were against. But the book itself has 9/11 in the background. 9/11 is still steering American foreign policy in lots of ways. And here in New York, I mean, I live, the tower is about 10 blocks from me. So that morning, I'm actually a Mets fan, long suffering. And I was watching, I was looking at the Mets box score, and that plane came over so quickly and so low, I thought it was coming into my building. I banged my head down on the table. It was that intense. And then within a second, there's this sound like a huge sledgehammer hitting concrete. That's what it was like. And ran up on the building, up on the roof. And that sight, the first sight of that plane stuck in the North Tower with the black smoke coming out and the flames, it burned into my mind. And then the second plane hit soon after. And I thought, I'm going down there, man. I'm going to take a look at this, because I knew it was going to be cut off pretty soon. So I ran down. I knew the barricades would be put up at Broadway and Canal Street. And I live right next to Canal. So I ran down Broadway past it. No one was there yet. Smoke is coming up. I got down about 6-7 blocks. I'm only about 10 blocks away from it. But then the smoke and the dust was just so intense that I had to come back. And being in Black 47, we were the house band of New York City at that point. So everything closed down, you know, in New York at that point. But we had the residency going in Connolly's on 45th Street. And there was nothing for first responders to do. So we said, well, we're going to start playing. So we played that next Saturday night, and the place was jammed. And then, you know, one of the things that struck me that led to the book was before we got on stage, whenever the door would open, everyone would turn around to look, because we didn't know who was dead and who was alive at the point. And then someone would walk into the room and everybody would go, oh, my God, Johnny's alive. And the whole room would run over and give him a bear hug, or, you know, Jane is alive. You know, she was working in the towers that day, and it was like that. And that left this huge imprint on me. So Black 47 then, as we would go around playing the tri-state area, people would come up to us with pictures of fans of ours and say, that's James or whatever, you know, he died, but his favorite song, yours is Fanatic Heart, can you do it for him? And it was mind-boggling, the intensity of it. So we did an album called New York Town to celebrate what had gone on beforehand, and then to celebrate coming through it. And but it wasn't enough, you know. I felt like I was missing something. And then I'm a playwright. I was a playwright before Black 47. So I thought, let me do a play on it. And that's when I came up with the Murphy family and the father, the wife, Jimmy, Maggie, the eldest son, Brian, who gets killed, and Kevin, his youngest, or his brother, and Brian's wife, Rose. So I did this play. It was called, I won't get into that, but it was The Heart is a Mind of Its Own, it was called. And it was a kitchen sink drama, and it went well. But as I was watching on stage, I think, I failed, man. It's like, this is not a kitchen sink drama. What was I even thinking of? This is a huge event that I didn't capture. And so about I was aware of my failure, and about 4 years after, I finally realized I should have done this as a novel. I'd already had a little bit of success by this point with a novel called Liverpool Fantasy about the Beatles. So I knew how to write novels at that point. So I started writing it. It took about 2 or 3 years. My agent sent it around, and everyone liked it, but there was something missing. And not only that, it felt too soon after the whole thing, because I didn't want to go around and promote it myself. I was thinking, yeah, it feels like it's taken advantage of the whole thing. So we withdrew the whole thing, and every year around 9/11, I'd think about it. And then in 2018, right, I have a show on Sirius XM called Celtic Crush.
Right.
And as I was going to do the show that day, I was thinking, man, it's been a long time. And I was thinking, I could write this book right now. I could go back to it. And I told the story of the book on Celtic Crush. And Dean Smith, the head of Cornell University Press, was a fan of the shows, was listening to it. And he got in touch with me and said, you know that book you were talking about? Send it on to me and let me take a look. And he got back to me and said, let's do it. And I was thinking, yeah, I'm ready for it now. And, you know, it needed a lot of work, and it took about 2 years. And another editor there, Michael McGandy, challenged me a lot about it. And they were really challenged and saying, you got to get deeper. You got to get deeper into this. You got to show this is an important story. And they drove me around the bend, actually, at certain times. But I go back to it because I knew it was the story of those people who didn't come through the door in Connolly's on that first night. You know, it was the story of Brian, the eldest son, and his father, and a difficult relationship. And the father finds out that the son was actually in the North Tower 30 minutes beforehand. What was he doing there?
Yeah,
and nobody will tell him. And that's the crux of the story. Then once I found out how to do that, then it became a drama too. But I was able to get into this guy, Detective Sergeant Jimmy Murphy, who's kind of washed up and
a vet,
finds
Vietnam vet. Yeah.
Vietnam vet, yeah, and has suffered there and has his own secret because of that. And he has to find out what his son was doing there. And even though it'll probably break up his family because nobody knows, nobody will tell him what he was doing there, and he has to find out and upset everyone by doing it. And then he finally does find out.
It's a beautiful, you tell it so beautifully, and the writing is so gorgeous. And I was just thinking too that this is like is also a quintessential Irish story, in the sense that you have a father trying to navigate a difficult relationship with his dead son, and you think, well, yeah, who else could write that? I mean, that's just misery and despair there, but you do it so beautifully, and it's just it's very lovely and meaningful. But I want to get back to, because you brought so many of those aspects to the music, to the lyrics too, because as I said, when you were in the bar and you were listening to you guys play, it was fantastic. But, you know, then when you stopped and listened to what you were saying, it was there was so much there. So I would assume that even as you said you were a playwright prior to Black 47, that you had acquired that voice long ago as being able to convey and to bring us to an emotional place.
Well, here's the weird thing about it. I was in a band before that called Major Thinkers, and we had a big record deal with with Epic Records, and we were like a punk new wave band from the Lower East Side, and eventually, as happens to bands, we got dropped. And you know, I'd been playing pretty much all my life at this point, and I thought, wow, you know, I really should give the playwriting a real chance. And so I walked away from rock music totally. You know, I thought, this is it. I'm finished. It's over. Now I'm going to become a playwright. But I'm going to do it the old punk way, DIY, you know, do it yourself. I'm going to write plays, but I'm not going to submit them to big playhouses or anything, because I had friends who are playwrights and they're always waiting for someone to, you know, give them a break. And so I had this play called Liverpool Fantasy about the Beatles, if they hadn't made it. And I gathered people around me and I said, let's do this, man. You know, let's do it. And we found a theater and we did it, and it was a success. It was my first play. So, you know, I was off to the races, as it were. So for 4 years, I did that, and I not only, you know, wrote the plays, I directed them sometimes, I produced them, you know, I cleaned the, I cleaned the toilets, cleaned the stage, whatever it took to get the play on. So I was totally submerged in that world before I joined Black 47. And as I said earlier, Chris and I were thrown into the scene up in the Bronx. We were playing 3-4 nights a week. Everyone hated us. So we weren't really thinking, what are we playing or anything like that? It was like, you got to get through this night. We're getting better. We're a little better every time. And if you play 4 nights a week, it was kind of like the Beatles in Hamburg being in the Bronx for us. You're getting better and you're getting more confident. And Chris had a gun anyway, so we were
he had a badge and a gun, we should know, but yes.
As Chris used to make a snide announcement every time, we have the only legal gun in this place.
But but your writing and the lyrics, and we only have a few minutes left, but about three. But your writing was very, it seems to me, in those early days, very autobiographical. Is that true?
Yeah, I was writing just off the top of my head. I'd learned how to. It was character writing. That's what happened. Every song had a lead character in it, like they would have in a play. And I didn't realize that until we started getting write-ups and critics started saying, this guy writes stories. You know? I was thinking, well, what else am I going to write? I don't know how to write anything else at this point. So I had a deep understanding of history. I was always a history buff. So, you know, I knew how to put a story together. It's an Irish trait anyway.
It is. Yeah.
Let the Irish in me go, you know. And speaking of which, you know, because we're talking about Albany, one of the people that really influenced me, because the play is about Rockaway Beach, a particular place. And your Bill Kennedy, my friend Bill Kennedy, influenced me so much, because when I came to Albany to play, I already knew Albany through Bill's books.
Yes.
And so I learned a lot from your man from Albany,
He's
Bill.
He's the best. Absolute
yeah.
best. So to the autobiographical part in the few moments that I have left, you know, one of the great things about being able to do a show like this is the people that you really admire, you get to ask them questions that normally you would never get to ask them. It's not something I would ask you normally. But so given the fact that many of the songs were autobiographical and you have a song that is called I Got Laid on James Joyce's Grave, the obvious question, of course, is... You know, did you?
Let's say it was heavy making out anyway.
All right. There you go. And I, you know, it was in that song that I learned that James Joyce wasn't even buried in Ireland. He was buried in Zurich. I didn't know that until I heard the song.
And it wasn't easy to find his place, although it is there if for those who know. But I actually had to go to a bar and get drinking and start shouting around, is anybody in this goddamn city know where James Joyce is buried? This is German, says yes. I killed him. That was it.
Apparently it was worth the wait.
It wasn't him I got laid with, though, by the way. Just want to get that right.
Well, the new novel is Rockaway Blue. It is published by Cornell University Press, and it's just a lovely read and such a beautiful, beautiful story. And Larry, I can't thank you enough for the past hour. It's just been an absolute delight talking to you and spending time with you, and I so appreciate it. And appreciate the great work and the many wonderful memories that you've provided over the past several decades.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and Albany was always a big part of our touring.
Well,
I still miss it.
Yeah, it's I could understand that of being and it's a good Irish town too. Larry Kerwin's new novel.
It's a good music town.
It is. That's the absolutely
thing. Yeah.
Rockaway Blue is the new novel, and your website has a lot on it too, including but it's black47.com, right? And you have a lot of cool stuff
and,
on there.
Yeah, and on Facebook too. We do a lot, Larry Kerwin or Black47 or Celtic Crush. Yeah.
All right, Larry Kerwin. Best to you. Happy St. Patrick's Day, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe. I appreciate it, man.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.